Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives and careers tell us how they work and why. Today, I'm talking to Luc Toymans, the Belgian artist attributed with bringing painting back from the brink of extinction in the 1990s with his influential, unflinching work that illuminates life, death and history, particularly history. What you see isn't quite what you get. Look again and find parallels, allegories, strange figures that haunt the recesses of your mind for weeks after leaving the gallery. Toymans' singular style has set him miles apart from pure stylists in paint, and it'll come as no surprise that his reality is a different place to dwell and observe from than the one the dictionary will insist upon. The surrealists were realists, he says. Toymans has a cool eye on the hot events of history then. Colonialism, he's Belgian, remember. The Second World War, his ski portrait of Albert Speer is eerie and ingenious, and power. But he also works from the ordinary and the banal. When imagery's everywhere, what's art, he might be asking. Some quick notes. Luc Toymans was born in 1958 in Mortsel near Antwerp and studied again in Belgium. The paint on the canvas may be minimally applied, but the thought behind it's like an avalanche. Paint and history, and he's a man, this man, Toymans. He's no media construct. We started by talking about another Belgian artist, the 19th century painter James Ensor, a show of whose he's curated at London's Royal Academy. Luc Toymans. Luc, thank you very much for your time today. I wanted to ask you first about your show at the Royal Academy. Mm-hmm. In conversation with James Ensor, as it were. Is there a lineage in Belgian painters?
There is always a clear lineage in Belgian painters, but I mean, I remember seeing Ensor when I was 16, when I still had the chance to see the other big painting, The Entry of Christ in Brussels, was in the same museum, and then was still owned by an Antwerp collector family. Actually, the residue of that lives in London now. And then it was, unfortunately, ended up in the Geddes Foundation, and we can't even lend it anymore. But one of the paintings that always struck me as a kid, and till this very day I think is one of the most powerful ones, is the one he painted 1 year later, which is The Intrigue, and that's for also the title of the show.
And The Intrigue, are you referring to one painting? Are you referring to your view on that artist?
Yes, it was a shocking painting, because if you then sort of try to think the times when it was made was firstly not very evident. One can think about Ensor as grotesque, and one can think about Magritte as surreal, but they aren't in a way. They deal with a certain type of reality, although the one of Ensor is a different one. But nevertheless, together with people like Munch, who created The Cry also, which is a painting on the dot, they were the clear precursors of Expressionism. It's also funny that actually now there is a very big show of abstract expressionism underneath my show, which is rather bombastic, but on the other hand, it also clearly shows what the CIA did as a covert operation.
It is, after all, underneath your show.
Yeah.
Well, people can read into that what they will.
No, and the other thing was that when Tim Marlowe and Adrian Lockie asked me that, I was not very well aware that the British don't really know Ensor that well, which is quite shocking in terms of ignorance. I mean, we had Brexit and now this. So in a sense, I thought that was even more an instigation to actually go forward with it. And the good thing is that we are very lucky that the museum in Antwerp is still rehabbing, and it's not open yet until 2019, and so we got really hold of the major works of Ensor, which is in particularly mostly in that museum. We got from Brugge, Brussels and wherever else. But
so they don't normally travel, and we
these
have them
paintings
here.
Would have never traveled if the museum was open now.
I wanted to ask you about that. We talked about lineage just now and the idea of Ensor being a realist and Magritte being not a surrealist.
But it's more the idea of the real, of how you make an interpretation of the real, in a
Do
sense.
They have X-ray specs? Because people think this about your work, Luc, that you also don a pair of X-ray specs when you go into the studio, that your canvases see through the flesh and bone to something underneath, which is something that people think about James Ensor as well. Perhaps.
Well, James Ensor, of course, there is also an element of a very political stance. I mean, when the work was made, Europe was a little bit in turmoil, as it is right now, too, in a different perspective, of course, and other things are at stake. But I think what predominantly was occupying Ensor's mind was not only the grotesque, but also sheerly the element of populism, which came up in the days, you know, with socialist parties that came up. those things was born around that time. And although he was fairly liberal, he was, of course, also a bourgeois. So there was an element of initiated an immediate fear against the crowd, in a sense. Now, the intrigue is, of course, a lesser crowd, and it's been said that it's also more a personal painting and that there are other things. But nevertheless, you can see that there is a Greek mask, that there is the one head with the strange hairdo, was actually a critique on a French judge who was pretty hard on free speech and things like that. So there are all these things. Because, of course, he thought and pretended too late in life that it all fell out of thin air and he was a genius. But in fact, he also looked at the encyclopedia of the caricature of Champfleury, which was very instigating when he was a young man. So it came from somewhere. So it was also a little bit in the air to a point.
Is that one of those things, Enzo perhaps did this well, being an artist and looking like you're not trying?
No, but also he was against academism, fairly. He was a great, great painter. You will see that in the show. I incorporated a lot of drawings where you can see the draftsman. And from early on, you know, there's one drawing of a self-portrait who was 18 years old. Well, that can make Picasso go home.
Yeah, that'll do. Can we go to your studio now?
Mm.
I'm interested in this idea of lineage, and James Enzo grew up in outside of the main realms of Belgium, like you did. And what was that like? Is there still a bit of the boy noticing things in the man in the studio now? Do you think differently with a paintbrush in your hand? Do you reminded of your childhood when you do that?
What I see in Enzo's work is, first of all, a great painter. That's one thing, and somebody had at least a lot of pleasure painting. I think that's, if you don't have pleasure with it anymore, you might as well stop. I mean, that also has to do, he has an enormous amount of intensity. I also suppose these paintings were painted with a certain speed, as I also paint paintings. I mean, I paint a painting in a day. The preparation of those images takes a long, long time. I don't know how that went with Enzo. I think it was he was much more big on intuition, so he was also a different time and a different artist. And created a style, which I definitely don't want to do, although after 600 paintings, there is definitely a style, but that was not the outset of the game. And so there are quite different situations. Also, I've traveled much more than Enzo. Enzo firstly never traveled, and I travel 5 months a year. So,
after 600 paintings, then, what do you get, a tingle in your fingertips? When do you know that it's time to start work?
Well, it's when everything is analyzed, when everything is there, and then been through a process of making drawings, maquettes, Polaroids of them, even myself, the web, whatever, when all the images are there. And then I actually come to the point that I don't want to think anymore. I want to shift my brain, or the intelligence of my brain has to shift to my hands. And this is a very important and powerful point, because it's like you have a track, like an actor could have like a vomit attack before he has to start, and the very first 3 hours already told that once to Adrian Searle are hell, because you don't see what you're doing, but then when it starts to come, then it falls together.
Is that the thing, starting? Is it frightening? Is it frightening to see a white
canvas? Still frightening, and you could say, okay, why would you be frightened after what you have achieved or after 30 years of painting? But it becomes actually worse. It doesn't go better. Also, I'm very well aware that there are tons of people that are going to wait till I make the very first mistake. And I was also very well aware, and this is a little different with Enzo, that being the proposition of an artist right now is a somewhat more inhumane one, because we have different functions, like doing this interview.
You're famous in a different way. Artists never used to have to do this. Right?
Exactly. And the thing is that I always understood, because when I started out, painting was virtually dead. It was like seen as an antique. And in order to show it, there had to be an explanation to it. There had to be a context to it, which is actually also what contemporary art, in accordance to modern art, did. I mean, it's a different context, modernism, so to speak. It's the context that is provided.
I know, I feel that you're against categorization in things.
And that answer was also against categorization. It's also very difficult to categorize, because in this show you will see a multitude of ways of looking at them. There's also one thing which I particularly wanted to have in the show, and it's a friend, colleague of mine, who's actually here. He's a bit older, he's 71. He's an installation artist, Guillaume Bayle, which probably may or may not be that well known here. And he works and makes installations, some very large ones, from found objects. And he actually made in 2002 what I regard as a small contemporary masterpiece. He made a fake movie about Enzo on the beach in 1920 with an antique dealer out of Antwerp. And this is shown in the very first space next to the oldest work in the show. And although it's mentioned, of course, a lot of people will see this as the real found footage. And it also amplifies this sort of not only playfulness, but the element of the sardonic sort of take upon reality, which I think is very Belgian.
Do you talk about that? Do you talk about subject matter and finding a great picture?
You always have to have a discussion with somebody. In most cases, that's, of course, my wife, Carla Rocha. It was also in her own right an artist. And with friends and people, because, I mean, you need a sort of feedback. I mean, that's what I say. I mean, and like, I will tell you a very funny story to make it more particular in terms of Enso. So when I was 18, I won a prize between all the academies. Actually, in the far end, I was shoved off of every academy. One thing I studied, though, as a working student was, because I hated students, was at a free university in Brussels, where I finished, which is art history. But anyway, when I was 18, I win this prize with a self-portrait, which I actually got the idea when I was coming back from Budapest, Hungary, and I traveled to Hungary and closed my eyes and saw this sort of self-portrait, which I made without a mirror in 15 minutes. But at that point, I couldn't realize that you could make a painting in 15 minutes. That was not possible. So I fucked it up. And I worked on it for a whole month to come close to this very first situation. With that one, I won a prize. Together with the money prize, which was a prize from a bank, we got a book, and the book was James Enso. And it fell open on the self-portrait, was exactly the same age, was like 18. And this painting is in the show. I made a big thing about it that we have it. And although formerly, I mean, my painting is not in the show or that particular painting, but it's in the catalog. But then I understood I didn't make anything authentic. I was rather sick of it for like 2 weeks. And that's where my very first rather regressive idea came from, of the authentic forgery. So we instigated that.
I wanted to ask you to go back to your studio and starting something. If you finish a painting in a day, obviously it's bouncing around in there, it's scratching around inside your head before it becomes something on the canvas. How do you know when something's finished? I always ask songwriters this and artists.
It is in the beginning when I didn't have any money and I lived in my studio, which was my home, which also meant, because of the turpentine, that every sexual relationship was a one-night stand. But that was the point where I've destroyed most of it, because I was close to the work. I mean, I sort of lived with it. It is when I got a more steady relationship that I could use that studio, which I used till very long, till 2005, I think. It looked a bit like Francis Bacon. The new studio is something completely different now.
How is it different?
Because it's much more, it's a bigger one, and it has heating. And
so you can't make so much
mess in it. It has running water, and it has a good toilet. And so it's from that point on when I could actually sort of decided the point that I would make a distinction between the working place and where I would live. That helped me a lot. And that saved me, in a sense, from destroying things. And I think it's because I go there, and when I close the door, I know it was worked or not. And now, of course, I have the luxury to just throw it away, and your formerly that are overpainted. Some of the paintings that exist, they have 9 other paintings underneath them, and not necessarily bad paintings. I also have, in retrospect, I have to say that I overpainted paintings that I shouldn't have overpainted. But that was out of sheer necessity.
But and you don't do that anymore?
No, because I have the luxury not to do that. So, and I just throw it away and start again, or not. But, I mean, when do you stop? You stop, it's a hard thing to learn, and it comes with experience, I think. Yeah. Picasso always said that, too. You have to know when to stop. It's the masterly touch, in a way. Because you can easily go over it
and then spoil it.
And also when a painting is too worked, too arbitrary, and loses the air that it should have inside and the immediacy, then it mostly fails. And it mostly fails from a distance.
And I came to see your show at David Zwerner Gallery here in London a couple of years ago, The Shore, or maybe 3 years ago. And I interviewed him. He's a serious guy, he's a straight guy. Mm. He was impish in his enthusiasm, bouncing around like a leprechaun, talking about your work. Mm. And you have a very old association with him going back. He was
From the beginning.
Yeah, from the beginning, right? How did that relationship start?
Well, I have to say I have a great respect for David and what he achieved, and he's very loyal and a very generous person also, besides the fact that he, of course, remains German. But the thing is that he was introduced by his father to me, to my dealer, with which I'm also already working 26 years. We'll be here for the opening. And there's still an anniversary show open with 10 new works and 15 loans of the 17 shows I've done there. And he came to this to my dealer in Antwerp and myself, of course. And the father introduced the son, which was a very odd thing to do. And then I had to make him come five times to Belgium, basically, because there was other interests. There was Barbara Gladstone, there were like the big animals. Mm. But I thought it would be more interesting to start up with somebody that had still had to make a name for himself than to become a name between other big names. And I think I made the right choice, seeing the fact that now it is a rather big enterprise, which on the one hand is great, on the other hand could be problematic. So it's, because I mean, and this is, of course, not only his story, the story of a lot of these big dealers, not in the least Gagosian. Mm. But I wouldn't like to be a young artist right now. That I'm pretty honest about this. I think it's a very, very difficult endeavor right now, just because of this element of the corporate and the fact that if you're an intelligent young artist and you become part of the consortium, you also sort of immediately realize you could be branded. Which I had the luck to be being born earlier and didn't have this type of strategy or the necessity of it. On the other hand, I can't criticize a hand that feeds me and in a way also have a respect for what David actually built, which is an amazing thing. And it is also, of course, this thing that enables you to be supported. There's something that protects you against the market in terms of auction houses and things like that. Those have become all things that are now entangled within contemporary art.
And when you started, as you said, you alluded to this at the beginning, people said, oh, painting was dead, and you kind of were one of the knights in shining armor to reinvigorate it and give it meaning and make it cool.
Yeah, that's because I always sit and I still say that, because I've been having this question a lot about painting being dead or alive, which I think is a very hollow discourse and a misunderstanding of theoretical things that were put out, not in the least by Duchamp. And other people have clearly a misunderstanding. No artist that I know have ever asked me that. It comes out of the realm of journalists, critics, and so on. The standard answer to that is very simple, because I'm not naive. Painting has always been art. It's nothing to do with life. So
there's the realism again. It's that lineage of realism.
Yeah, or reality.
It might be dancing skeletons, but it's real from where you're looking. Mm. You have a reputation of being someone that knows what they mean and mean what they say. Mm. And do you feel like that when you're in your studio as well? Is that a different
version? I am one of the most shy, insecure people you can imagine. It might not seem that way, because in public I will never show it. That has to do with my education, my upbringing. I also have quite a pessimistic worldview, because you cannot be disillusioned that fast. I've been pestered in school like there was no fucking tomorrow. And I've never forgave that, never forgot that either. So it forms a personality. And in that sense, it guards you or puts you on guard. But that doesn't mean there is no doubt. There is constant doubt. But that doubt is not something you should extrapolize into the world. That's a very private point. You know?
Yeah, but I'm interested in that, because we've said artists are different animals now. Well-known artists are different
animals than they had to be. There is still an artist, male, female, is still an artist. It remains a gigantic conviction. I mean, it remains a gigantic risk. It is also not a hobby. It's a life. And it is 24 and 24 hours, and people, old or are they young, are probably still passionate about it. I think passion is a very enormous, on the one hand, it's a good thing. It can also be a predicament.
I wonder how, when you visit galleries, when you see things, as you say, you travel a lot, a lot of ideas are bouncing around all the time, I'm sure, but when you go and see other shows, do you look at... I went to see a Paul Nash show today at the Tate. And
That's one of my preferred English painters.
I love him.
I haven't seen it yet, but I saw a program of it at 3 o'clock at night in my hotel room. And it's one of the really odd painters.
Yeah.
Stanley Spencer.
He doesn't seem English to me in that way.
There is a very solitary stroke in the man's oeuvre, and it probably will have to do with the shock of the First World War. Mm. And then again, he was appointed a war painter in the Second World War, made a masterpiece, which is the graveyard of the paintings, which is a painting I always went to see in the National Gallery. And... that's immediately clear that is something very particular that stands out amongst the painters. And it's a very personal trajectory also.
Yeah.
With Enzo, it's a little bit the same thing. I think a lot of painters that I like have a very singular stance to them, and also a position. They take a position, and I think... Well, Nash did that, Enzo did that, Goya did that, Velázquez did that. Rubens was the first PR. He was the first Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking that, knowing that I was going to interview you this afternoon, Luke, I saw that idea of reality. He saw there was an element of surrealism to his work, but that was definitely real to him. I could tell that. Maybe because we come from the same place, that you came from the same place as Ensor, very approximately. And I wondered that. I wonder when you look at paintings, other people's work, whether you're looking at the idea or whether you're looking at the technique, whether you get up close to the canvas or whether you...
I always get up close to the canvas, and because I am a painter and I want to see how things are made. I don't want to see it in the first instance, also not with my work. The first instance is the image, then you see it. It's the same way I made a quote that if an image reproduces better than the actual painting in real life is, you have a problem. So... because that is the exact difference between a photographic or a monitored image, is that this is a man-made image. And although I'm not going to go as far as I'm my work, and my work is me, because I think that's ludicrous, but nevertheless, there is the trace. And the human trace is very difficult to remember because it's very complex. And therefore, this interest, of course, if you go look at paintings and of works of other people, is to look at how they are also made. And how they are intrinsically made. And you can really feel when you see a good painting, like with Paul Nash, you can see also where he stops, how he puts on the paint. And you feel this gigantic intentionality, which I think is really important for a good image, for a good painting. And with most painters, that's the case. That goes from there to Courbet or whatever. And there is also no real nationality on it. Art, I hope, doesn't have any boundaries in that sense.
And when you walk into a room of paintings, do you look in an order? Do you go clockwise, anti-clockwise, or do you always walk up to the one that catches your imagination first?
I will look to the image that strikes me.
Yeah.
And that's what the painting should always have a weak spot that makes you enter. But that weak spot is at the same time the stronghold of the whole idea, is where the armor sort of explodes. And if it doesn't have that, there's only, of course, one exception. And that is a difficult one, and that is, of course, Jan van Eyck, which has been the trauma, and will be the trauma till I die, because he's the best painter in the Western Hemisphere, because he's just perfect and unforgiven.
And he's a tough...
This is one of the most toughest, and also on a conceptual level, thinking about the fact that he was working under the cloak of religion, as anybody did at that point, even science was under that, but he heightened the idea of flesh, color, texture, and he got away from the mimetic imagery of Christianity and opened it up to the world. And one of my very preferred paintings is in London, which is the Arnold Finis International Gallery. And of course, the motto of Van Eyck was a very interesting one, because it was, if I can, which means I'm big on humility, but behind that I have the most gargantuic ambitions, of course, which is also, again, this realism, which has to do with an element of survival, basically. And you shouldn't forget that we have been overruled by a lot of foreign powers.
You mean the Belgians?
Yeah, as a region and as a country, it's very young, it's 1830, it's younger than this country. But I mean, as a region, has always been impaired by under other rule, and therefore we had to be opportunistic to survive. So we never had time to be romantic like the Germans or something like that. There was no real opportunity for that.
There is something forensic about that stuff. It's dark. It's Northern European. It's brooding. It's all these things. People attribute these adjectives to your work. I wanted to ask you about Der Architekt, which is a classic, I guess, and it's like a lot of your things, that it demands a second reading, a third. You can't stop looking at this thing. You wonder why you're looking at it, and then you realize someone tells you it's Albert Speer.
Well, the funny thing is that
he's a toppled skier. This is the most amazing darkness in naivety anyone's seen on a canvas in 50 years.
Well, the funny thing is, when I showed it in my show in the Neue Nationale Gallery, I went back for a talk, and by accident, one of the grandchildren of Albert Speer, with the exact same name, also being an architect, was in front of the painting.
Okay.
Which is only something that can happen in an elliptical country like Germany, which means that the Germans have always been high on culture, in a sense. That's one of the good things, and was also the unfortunate mistake. So, it is a painting that draws you in because of the blank, basically, which is the face, which was a deliberate blank. And it's also derived from a media image, because it comes from out of a reportage from the same year as the painting was made in 98, about the henchmen of Hitler or something at Arte, on the Arte channel. But what was fascinating with it is that you see this sort of, yeah, family footage, but probably made by his wife. And it was already 1944, and the guy was also Minister of Defense, and he was really very good at it. And so he actually prolonged the war. And it was also in that year that actually the Russians released a telegram, which had never been released before, but they would have happened, they would have hung him in Nuremberg, where was the only written proof that he also knew what was going on in the death camps and the labor camps. And he had visited one of them and thought that the inmates had too much space. And in an overflow, you see him coming skiing, going down the slope, falling and turning around. And this element of blindness was something that really captivated me.
That is an amazing story behind an amazing painting. Do you always know what you're thinking when you're doing it? Do you know why an image suggests itself
for me,
to you?
Since I work with representational imagery, already represented imagery that I rework, I have to know what it means. Otherwise, I can't really make it. That doesn't mean that everybody has to see that exact same meaning in it, because I think that would also be not good for an artwork. An artwork is also always multi-layered. But for myself, it is very necessary. It's also therefore that I don't make abstract paintings. Abstract paintings are too emotive for me. I'm too much of a detached person to do that. And figuration gives me this extreme detachment. It's actually pretty abstract to a point.
After 600 paintings, and your friendship with David Zwirner and all these luminaries and traveling 5 months a year, and this is such a big, bold, kind of full world, the art world. Mm. And there are very few people that do it brilliantly in paint, but do you feel pressure when you put the paint of the point of your paintbrush on the canvas next time?
No. I mean, I know that the only pressure is the pressure I put on myself, which is the pressure in putting the bar higher and also having more pleasure. I mean, it's an important thing. And I allow myself a bit more painterly freedom than, like, let's say, the paintings I've made in the 80s. Because that was a clear break with what I was doing. And also had an interruption of 5 years where I worked with film, which enabled me to create distance to actually make what I wanted to make, let's say, in the 70s. Because I was too close, too existential, too tormented, and it was suffocating, so I needed a sort of break.
Do you kind of know when you're getting a rich seam of form, when you're hitting your stride as an artist, do you know that? Do you kind of go, I've done it, this, I can do this?
You feel it.
Yeah.
You just feel it. And this is also why painting is something very physical. It's by the one hand, it's a way of thinking, that's one, but it also has a very physical impact on even the person who makes it. Because when you do something that is really, really, to a point, it escapes you to a point, but you know that it's really correct and that virtually nobody will see it. You had the correct feeling. And you know that's where you actually also finish the painting. This is the point blank, where you can either say, now I go further and I go over, or I just leave it.
And that's the perfection, right? That's when you
know. Well, imperfection with imperfection. Well, I don't believe in perfection. I mean,
that's when you know you've done a good job.
But that's when you know you've reached your limits. I mean, it's also about limits. People are limited. As is also every image is limited. It's just a very, very, very special experience.
What happened, just finally, to those overpainted canvases in the crowded Francis Bacon studio? What, they end up being picnic tables or firewood?
No, I mean, the paintings I overpainted are now museums because they have a painting on top of it, and the museums can x-ray them, and which is fine. And we found some old snapshots of the paintings underneath, which will be incorporated in the catalogue raisonné on which we are working. So,
well, thank you very much. It's power to them, and it's value for money. Five Luc Tuymans for the price of one. Luc Tuymans, thank you very much. Indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, in conversation with Luc Tuymans. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie and Gaia Lutz and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.